In this lecture, and in the next two lectures, I will give a quick, steep description of second quantization to give you a quick introduction to the subject and intuition. And then, after that, we will go more slowly, more systematically, and build everything up for curved space-time. But this lecture and the next two are still going to be on flat space-time, just quantum field theory, pure second quantization on a steep path. But the idea is to do, I'd like to give you the intuition behind it all. So a taste of quantum fields. Consider this scene here, some water waves, surface of a pond. What's going on over there? Well, there's going to be waves, obviously, and it's similar to the acoustic field in this room. It's similar to the electromagnetic field in this room. There's always going to be some waves traveling in all sorts of directions. And of course, fluctuations of those as well. How would we visualize those fluctuations? Well, we can throw a piece of cork from a wine bottle into the water, and then what it'll do is bob up and down, tracking the height of the surface of the water. Now, if the water was completely still, and we throw this cork in there, it'll bob up and down in a more or less sinusoidal way. And in a pond like this, if we plot the up and down of this cork, it'll be a curve like this one. Now imagine we had not just one cork in there, but a bunch of them, four or five or more of them. Then each one of them would bob up and down. Each one of them would have a curve like this, the amplitude over time. And we would get a plot like this. There would be four different corks, and they all bob up and down. So in principle, we have what looks like harmonic motion, but these corks are not independent, because the waves travel from one to the other. There is motion going on. And so we have coupled systems. In fact, if you took one of those corks and you move it with your hand up and down in the water, that alone would create waves, even if the pond was otherwise still. That alone would create waves that would be felt by the other corks. So what we should expect is going on in water is that we have harmonic oscillators because of the sinusoidal motion, but they will have to be coupled to each other. And that's, roughly speaking, what we have. In the case of water waves, it's actually more complicated than simply having at each point in space a harmonic oscillator where the cork could bob up and down, and that these harmonic oscillators are coupled. No, in fact, for water waves, it's much more complicated. The coupling between the harmonic oscillators is non-trivial, and also these are not really harmonic oscillators in the case of water waves, because as you may know already, the speed of propagation of water waves depends on the amplitude of the water wave. These things are much simpler in the case of electromagnetic waves, whose speed does not depend on the amplitude. We properly have harmonic oscillators. The frequency of the harmonic oscillator does not depend on the amplitude of its elongation. That is the hallmark of a harmonic oscillator. No matter how high the amplitude is, the frequency of oscillation is always the same. We don't have that for water waves. But the picture is very similar. So for electromagnetic waves too, you can imagine it to be very similar. We have locally harmonic oscillators, but they are coupled to each other. So we have a system of coupled harmonic oscillators. Therefore, the plan now is going to be this. Let us quickly review some basic facts of harmonic oscillators. Then, let us review some basic facts of relativistic fields, then second quantization, And finally, we put these things together and we studied the harmonic oscillators of fields. So we take fields and decompose them into the harmonic oscillators that they are made out of. And then we will see that the ground state fluctuations of a quantum harmonic oscillator translate into corresponding ground state fluctuations of the harmonic oscillators, of the infinitely many harmonic oscillators that are contained in a quantum field. And these ground state fluctuations are then called vacuum fluctuations. And we will study how to calculate vacuum fluctuations. Okay, so let's start with some basic stuff, harmonic oscillators. And even more basic, classical harmonic oscillators. I'm going through this tedious detail because I want to make a few subtle points clear, so I hope you don't mind that we start with some very simple stuff. So the Hamiltonian is p squared over 2 plus omega squared half q squared. We're choosing our units such that there's no extra mass term. In this case, there are two equations of motion. P dot is minus omega squared q. P dot is q double dot. So clearly we get the sine and the cosine solutions. We also have that q dot is equal to p by virtue of choosing the unit such that the mass is 1. Some people would say that this is not really an equation of motion, it's a definition, but that depends. It depends on whether you work in the Hamiltonian or in the Lagrangian framework. So for our purposes, let's use the terminology where we say these are both equations of motion. Now for the classical harmonic oscillator, the lowest energy solution, and we are ultimately going to be interested in lowest energy solutions because they can correspond to the vacuum of a quantum field. Quantum field can be decomposed into harmonic oscillators. The lowest energy state can be the vacuum. Well, that is for the first few lectures that's going to be true. But then we're going to find out that the vacuum state is not the state of minimum energy. It's not the lowest energy state. It's a subtle thing. But let me be more precise. The vacuum state, as being defined as the state of no particles present, that is not the state of lowest energy. In order to understand these subtle distinctions, we will have to be very careful about what is the lowest energy state, what are the properties of it, what is the state of no particles, what are its properties, and then compare them. So we'll do these things very carefully. For a classical harmonic oscillator, what is the lowest energy solution? Well, clearly it's the solution where the position q is for all times at zero, at the origin, where the potential has its minimum, and the momentum is zero, and the particle just sits there. The Hamiltonian, that is the energy, is zero for all times with this solution. Classically, the situation is that nothing moves here, and we are sure about it. There's no uncertainty of a classical or quantum kind about it. Nothing moves, no energy, and we are sure about it. Okay. So the point is, if the particle was a little bit to the left or to the right, well, then it would have to be with elevated energy. It's not. It's right there where the potential is zero. That's why the energy of the lowest energy state is zero. Now let's compare that with the quantum harmonic oscillator. Remember, the principle of quantization is that the Hamiltonian stays the same, the equations of motion stay the same as in the classical theory, but the canonically conjugate pairs of variables, in our case q and p, no longer commute. So the Hamiltonian is still this one. The equations of motion are still those. And you see that, of course, with this principle, we end up in the Heisenberg picture, where the observables are dependent on time, not the state vectors. Okay, so the Hamiltonian stays the same as in the classical theory. Also, the equations of motion formerly look the same, but now the q and the p are not commutative. So therefore, the q and the p and the Hamiltonian, etc., all of these observables have to be operator-valued rather than number-valued functions. Now, how does that impact our harmonic oscillator? And in particular, what's the lowest energy solution now? Keeping in mind that we'll have to use whatever we find here later on for quantum field theory and the vacuum state. So the lowest energy state that we may call psi naught for the lowest state naught, right? And then psi 1 would be the first excited state, etc. The lowest energy state is an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, so it obeys this equation here. And we don't need to rederive this. You know that, of course, that the lowest energy of a quantum harmonic oscillator is 1/2 h bar omega, which is larger than zero. So somehow, through the quantization, the ground state energy of the harmonic oscillator went up by 1/2 h bar omega. Why is it elevated? Why is it larger than zero? This will be important because in quantum field theory, we will see that the fields can be decomposed into independent harmonic oscillators. They're not even coupled. We can decompose them with suitable choice of variables. We can decompose quantum fields into independent harmonic oscillators that each have their ground state energy. And that adds up to an infinity. And one of the procedures of standard quantum field theory is to throw away that energy, to disregard it, which in the case of gravity, we don't properly get away with. Now, this is going to be a fundamental issue of quantum field theory and, of course, of quantum gravity. So let us review why it is that quantum harmonic oscillators have an elevated ground state energy. Because remember that in non-gravitational theory, absolute values of energy don't matter. As we will see later again, I'll rederive it. Absolute values don't matter, but in gravity, they do matter. In classical theory, it's only energy differences that matter, because energy differences lead to power if it's energy difference over time, or force if it's energy difference over space, right? dE by dx or dE by dt. It's power or force. But the absolute value of energy doesn't matter classically. But in the Einstein equation, you have the energy momentum tensor on the right-hand side. It's directly responsible for the Ricci curvature. So therefore, any amount of energy should matter. So before later, we just follow blindly what is usually done, which is to disregard ground state energy of quantum fields, let us look at where it's from and how unavoidable or avoidable the ground state energy really is. So the lowest energy of a harmonic oscillator is elevated. Why? Let's see where it comes from. Let us consider the eigenbases of the position operator q hat. So these vectors q, these ket vectors q, are the eigenvectors of our position operator q hat. Q hat acting on the state q is q times q. For all real values of q, because the position operator has the entire real line as its spectrum. These vectors are continuum normalized. So the overlap of q and q prime, where these are two position eigenvectors, is given by the Dirac delta. We're just looking at the one-dimensional harmonic oscillator for simplicity here. Then, let us look at what the ground state of the harmonic oscillator, which is an abstract Hilbert space vector, looks like as a wave function in the position basis. So we take the abstract ground state of the harmonic oscillator and calculate its overlap with the position eigenvector. This is the position wave function of the ground state of the harmonic oscillator, of course. And again, we don't need to rederive that. You've seen this many times, I'm sure. This is the wave function. It's a Gaussian. And what we see is that the higher the frequency of the harmonic oscillator is, the sharper is the Gaussian. You can think of it this way. If the harmonic oscillator has a very steep harmonic potential, so it looks like this, then the harmonic oscillator oscillates very quickly. If it's a very shallow potential, then it oscillates much more slowly. And the Gaussian of the ground state, and that's something that we don't necessarily have you can't have classical intuition for it. The ground state has this property that it's a Gaussian. Here I'm plotting it, which is it's a position wave function, which is Gaussian like this. And the steeper the potential, the sharper the Gaussian is. So the steeper the potential, the less will the particle venture to large elongations, because it's energetically expensive to do so. Right? If the potential goes like this very sharply, if it's a parabola that's very quickly rising, then it would be energetically very expensive for the particle to be far out, because the potential is very high there, and we're looking for the lowest energy state. On the other hand, if the parabola is very shallow, then the Gaussian is also very flat. So do we have in this case that our harmonic oscillator is resting at the position q equal to zero? Well, as far as the expectation value is concerned, yes. In the lowest energy state, psi naught, let us calculate what the expectation value of the position is. Let's call it q bar. Bar will always stand for expectation values. So the expectation value for the position in the ground state is given by this integral, where we have the wave function and the position operator here. This is a Gaussian, therefore an even function. That's a Gaussian, therefore an even function. That's an odd function. The whole thing is odd, and therefore the integral is zero. So the position expectation value vanishes, as is the case in classical mechanics. But that doesn't mean that we are sure to find the harmonic oscillator sitting at zero. And of course, you know how we can quantify that. We calculate what the standard deviation is in the position for the ground state of the harmonic oscillator. So we calculate the variance. We do it this way. We take the position operator minus the position expectation. This is a number because it's q bar. It's the expectation value. We just calculated it. This is zero. But generally, we calculate the variance by taking the actual value minus the expectation value and square that in order to get something positive. So it's the squared deviation from the mean. And then we calculate the expectation value of that. So the expectation of the squared deviation from the mean is the variance. And the square root of that is called the standard deviation, or the uncertainty. So the uncertainty in position comes out to be square root of h bar over 2m. So that gives us an indication of the width of that Gaussian. Okay, so this is how that looks like. The particle is most likely to be found close to zero, but there's a chance that we find it further away from zero, either to the left or to the right. And that is the reason why the energy of the ground state is elevated. You see, for the energy of the ground state to be zero, the particle would have to be sure to be found at zero, because only there the potential is zero. But the particle spends a lot of time away from zero, therefore in places of elevated potential. That's why the ground state of the harmonic oscillator is energetically elevated. If you calculate the energy expectation value, you literally calculate the sum of the contributions from the probability for the particle to be here multiplied with the energy that it has there, plus the probability for the particle to be there multiplied with the energy that it has over there. So it's literally what I just said. The energy expectation value is elevated because that sum of all probabilities times the energy that it has there is 1/2 h bar omega. I'm making this point to drive home the message that it's unavoidable. The ground state energy has a reason to be there. It's not just some mathematical subtlety. But the energy is elevated because the particle fluctuates away from the minimum of the potential, and therefore the expectation value of the energy has to be elevated over zero. We'll have to keep that in mind later on, because when we decompose a quantum field into its harmonic oscillators, then these fluctuations contribute in two ways, very badly. One is that each of these harmonic oscillators contributes 1/2 h/ω of its omega, and there is a continuum, infinitely many of these harmonic oscillators and these contributions, and they add up to an infinity. And on the other hand, the fluctuations themselves also mean that the quantum field's amplitude itself is completely uncertain. One harmonic oscillator wouldn't have that, but we have so many of them on top of each other in a quantum field when we decompose it that the amplitude becomes completely uncertain. Something, therefore, has to regulate it. I would like to add one thing that you might try to use to counter the argument. Let's go back to the point that our quantum field has infinitely many harmonic oscillators in it, as you will later see, and each one of them contributes 1/2 h/ω. And then you might say, well, yeah, but no wonder that there's an infinite amount of energy, because we're assuming space to be infinitely large. It's R3, after all. So whatever finite energy density the quantum field might have, once you integrate it up over an infinite volume, it's bound to be infinite. Right? It could be the tiniest of energy densities. It would be infinite if you integrate it all up. That's true. But, as we will see, even if you just integrate up over a finite volume, it's already infinite. So it's not just cumulatively infinite. No, the energy density itself is already infinite. And this is striking because from this argument we see that it's unavoidable that we have ground state energy, and these energies add up to infinity, and on the other hand, general relativity is sensitive to all energies. By the way, I just wrote a paper with former students of this class half a year ago with Yeet and Laura. And Yeet just came in before this lecture started and said that our paper was accepted. So look it up. Yeah, okay. Anyway, it would take a little too long to explain exactly what we did in there. Okay, so that was the review of harmonic oscillators. Now, a quick review of relativistic fields. So here we have the Schrödinger equation, for example, for a free particle. So we call it equation S. We'll later refer to it again. Just to make sure we are on the same page regarding the notation, this here is the Laplace operator, which is the sum of the squared partial derivatives. And on curved space-time, this is going to be looking somewhat differently. Okay, so we have the Schrödinger equation, and it is not relativistically covariant. However, the Klein-Gordon equation is better in that regard. So let us keep the usual identification of the momentum operators as acting on position space as minus I h bar d by dx, then the energy operator acts as I h bar d by dt. You see, this is really what the Schrödinger equation says. It says that the energy is equal to p squared divided by 2m, which is the non-relativistic relationship between energy and momentum for free particles. Energy equal to p squared over 2m. Now, so that's the same Schrödinger equation as we had before, just expressed in terms of E and P instead of expressing it directly in terms of these derivatives. Now, special relativity, however, says that this is not consistent. Instead, the special relativistic relationship between energy and momentum is this one. E squared over c squared minus p squared is mc c squared. M squared c squared. Or you may know it as P mu equal to m squared c to the fourth. This translates into a differential equation when we Fourier transform it into the position representation. This is the energy momentum basis, and in the time and space representation, we have that E acts as no longer as multiplication, it acts as IH bar d by dt. P then no longer acts as multiplication, it acts as minus IH bar d by dx. And so we obtain this equation here. I mean, here I could have multiplied the entire equation with psi of p. And here we have it multiplying psi of x. So this equation is the Klein-Gordon equation. And as such, it is a generalization of the Schrödinger equation, relativistic generalization of the Schrödinger equation, where we have maintained the relationship between energy and the time derivative and the momentum and the space derivative. And we have upgraded the relationship between energy and momentum to the special relativistic relationship. So here we have a relativistically covariant wave equation on Minkowski space. Usually it is written in this way. So we choose units such that the speed of light and the Planck constant have numerical values 1. Then the Klein-Gordon equation simply takes this form. Sometimes it's written even more compactly in this way, where we combine these two operators here, the second time derivative and the sum of the second space derivatives, into what is called the D'Alembert operator. Again, this is only how it looks like in Minkowski space, in curved space-time, or in non-Cartesian coordinates. It will look very differently, and we will get to this later on. So the Klein-Gordon equation takes this form, where the D'Alembert operator is dt squared minus the Laplacian. Some authors would define a minus sign in there, so you have to be a little careful. Or they might define a minus sign into the Laplacian. One generally has to be careful. There is no generally agreed upon sign convention. I can also tell you why that would be. It's because the Laplacian, the second space derivatives, if you define it as the sum of the second space derivatives, you can ask, what is its spectrum? It's a self-adjoint operator. It's just the sum of the square derivatives. Self-adjoint operator, what's its spectrum? It's a negative real line, right? Because what would be an eigenfunction to a second derivative? It was a plane wave, right? E to the power I x alpha. If you differentiate that twice, you get the I down twice. That's why you get a minus sign in front. And because some authors prefer the Laplacian to be defined in such a way that its spectrum is a positive half line, they just multiply it with a minus sign. So in other words, the Laplacian is sometimes the sum of the squared derivatives, squared partial derivatives in the spatial direction. Sometimes it's the negative of that. And then similarly, that translates into what you do for the D'Alembert. So in our notation, it's just going to be the sum of the second derivatives. It will have a negative spectrum. So is the non-relativistic limit okay? I indicated that in the previous lecture. So we need to show that in some sense, the Klein-Gordon equation reduces to the Schrödinger equation for small momenta, that is to say for small velocities, which is to say in the non-relativistic limit. Now, there is no really clean way to go from special relativity to non-relativistic theory. But the quick and dirty way is this. We consider again the relativistic relationship between the energy and the momentum. We solve this equation for the energy, because what we are aiming for is to derive the non-relativistic relationship between energy and momentum. So we solve that equation for the energy, and it is this. The plus and minus, because there are two roots of that equation. And then we choose the positive energy solution there, while keeping in mind we threw away a negative energy solution. And then we do an expansion of what is in the discriminant of that root for small p vector, for small p vector squared. Now, is that a good approximation usually? It is usually a good approximation, because compare what the two terms are. We have mc squared squared. That's the rest mass energy of a particle. And that is just, you know, p squared. Generally, the rest mass energy is much bigger for non-relativistic velocities than the kinetic energy. For example, if you run, you have kinetic energy. You can calculate in joules how many joules of kinetic energy you have. Compare that to the mc squared that you have. It's way smaller, which means non-relativistic theory is quite appropriate to describe you running. And so if we have particles that are not moving too fast, then it's easy to see how this could be by far dominant, and that's a small perturbation. If we do this, then if we do a Taylor expansion, the lowest order term is, of course, where p squared is zero. So we just get the square root of m squared c to the fourth. So it's just mc squared. And then the next coefficient, Taylor coefficient, is this one, to be evaluated, of course, at p squared equal to zero, because we're expanding around p squared equal to zero. So we get, you know, this 1 over square root in a denominator. But to be evaluated at p squared equals zero, plus terms in p squared squared. That would be higher order terms. If we evaluate this at p vector equal to zero, that goes away. And the whole thing simplifies, and we obtain that the energy is mc squared plus p vector squared over 2m, plus terms that are in the fourth power of the velocity. So if you wanted to do an upgrade to the Schrödinger equation that takes next order relativistic effects into account, you may want to calculate what this extra term is. So we got back the Schrödinger equation, the relationship between energy and momentum, which is that energy is p squared, p vector squared over 2m. Except we also got this term, the mc squared term, the famous E equal mc squared term. Now that term doesn't do anything in quantum mechanics, which is why Schrödinger got away with omitting it. You know, when Schrödinger first wrote down the Schrödinger equation, and Heisenberg first wrote down the Heisenberg equations of motion, which are equivalent, they both didn't include that term. And they got away with it because it makes absolutely no difference in the predictions of quantum theory. Why? How come that we can add to the energy this term and it makes absolutely no difference? Well, let's see. So the Schrödinger equation is now E equal to p vector squared over 2m plus mc squared with the psi, right? So that's the Schrödinger equation. And if we spell it out in the, not in the energy momentum basis, but in the basis of time and space, then the E becomes ih bar d by dt, and the p becomes minus ih bar over minus ih bar d by dx. So we get from here to there by a Fourier transform with respect to both space and time from energy and momentum. So this is our Schrödinger equation now, which looks exactly like the Schrödinger equation of Schrödinger, but there's this extra term in here. Does it do anything? Well, it's in quantum mechanics irrelevant for the following reason. The time dependence of an arbitrary observable f is given by the commutator between that observable and the Hamiltonian. And here we have the Hamiltonian, and we added something to it. And what we added to it is a constant. This is not multiplied with any operator x or p. It's multiplied with the identity operator, because it's just a number here. Which means that the addition of that term is, in the Heisenberg equation of motion, where this is easiest to see, is simply the addition to the Hamiltonian of a term which is some constant number times the identity operator. And what is the commutator between an observable and the identity operator, it's zero. So therefore, the time evolution of any arbitrary observable is not affected by the addition of a constant to the energy. Same thing. So this is the math behind the statement that in non-gravitational theory, everything is only sensitive to energies up to the addition of a constant. You can add or subtract any constant times the identity, it will make no difference for the actual dynamics. So no wonder that Schrödinger didn't put the term there because it wasn't needed. But now we see that coming from the Klein-Gordon equation, it would naturally be there. Okay, so a few remarks. First, the negative energy solutions that we omitted spoil the interpretation of psi of x and t as a probability amplitude density, which it used to be for the Schrödinger equation. But for the Klein-Gordon equation, it's just not the case that psi of x and t can still be interpreted as a probability density, probability amplitude density. It just doesn't work. And one of the key reasons is that we omitted half of the solutions. This problem is actually deep, and because it couldn't be resolved, people then started to study quantum field theory and second quantization, where the issue of negative energy solutions is then resolved in terms of the existence of antiparticles that are solutions that, from one perspective, look like they are negative energy solutions, but they are then reinterpreted as having positive energy but propagating backwards in time. So I showed you one way to go from the Schrödinger equation to a relativistic equation, namely the Klein-Gordon equation. But is that the only way? Of course it's not, and it's good that it's not the only way. There are many ways to write down relativistically covariant wave equations. Eugene Wigner in the 1940s developed a complete classification of relativistic covariant wave equations. And here is the gist of it. It's actually more detailed to what he found. But roughly what he found is that you can distinguish relativistic equations for spin 0, spin 1 half, spin 1, and higher spin particles. And for spin 0, you get the Klein-Gordon equation. For spin 1 half, you get the Dirac equation. For spin 1, you get the Maxwell or Young-Mills equations. Things are a little bit more subtle because it doesn't strictly have to be the Dirac equation. The Dirac equation can fall apart into two equations if the particle in question doesn't have a mass. And also the Maxwell equations aren't unique. You can have so-called Young-Mills fields, which is actually the case for the weak and for the strong interaction. Well, and then there are also higher order spin series. They are not observed in nature. We have never seen a fundamental particle of higher spin. We have seen composite particles of higher spin. For example, you can take a nucleus. A nucleus can have a bunch of neutrons and protons in it, and the whole thing can have a spin way higher than one. But these are not fundamental particles. Elementary particles are only known from spin 0 to spin 1. And this appears to be an interesting coincidence that the infinities that I talked to you about earlier today, the infinities in the ground state energy, or just in the energies in general of a quantum field theory, and the infinities in the amplitudes that arise when you just take the vacuum, the ground state fluctuations of all these harmonic oscillators that make up a quantum field, all of those infinities can be tamed by a procedure called renormalization. And it appears that that can only be done for fields with a spin of 0, 1 half, or 1. But even for 3 half, it would no longer work. Not in 3 plus 1 dimensions anyway. In lower dimensions you could, but not in 3 plus 1 dimensions. So what we have is an interesting coincidence. Namely, on one hand, we don't see any particles, any fundamental particles. No fundamental particles have ever been observed that would have the spin higher than 1. And on the other hand, we wouldn't even know how to handle the theory if they did exist. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that there cannot be such particles, because we may just not be clever enough to handle these infinities and actually handle theories of higher spin than spin 1. And in fact, that leads us to the issue that the graviton, if such a particle exists, well, it has never been observed, but if gravitational waves have also quanta, just like the electromagnetic waves have photons as their quanta, if gravitational waves have so-called gravitons as their quanta, they would have to have spin 2. And the fact that we don't know how to renormalize spin theories of spin larger than 1 translates into the fact that we don't know how to quantize gravity. It could be that there are no gravitons. That's maybe the framework of quantum field theory is burst in this case. Or it could be that there are gravitons and we just don't understand yet how to renormalize them. Okay, so where are we now in our 4-step plan? We've reviewed harmonic oscillators. We reviewed relativistic fields. Now, second quantization. Remember how that went? We discussed that a little bit last time. It was the observation of Heisenberg and a few others that in first quantization, in ordinary non-relativistic quantum theory, everything fluctuates except for the wave function. It evolves completely deterministically according to the Schrödinger equation. So they thought maybe the wave function itself should be considered a degree of freedom that has a canonically conjugate momentum, the time derivative, just like the momentum is the time derivative of the position. You would have the field. And it would, of course, any one field would be a collection of infinitely many degrees of freedom. Namely, at every position, we have an amplitude, which is the degree of freedom of the field. And then the time derivative of that amplitude gives you the canonically conjugate momentum to the field at this point. So the overall idea is that at every point in space, you have a degree of freedom, namely the amplitude. And then the time derivative of that amplitude is the canonically conjugate momentum there. So you have infinitely many, in fact, uncountably infinitely many degrees of freedom, and they're canonically conjugate ones. So you can imagine that the desperation must have been high that they considered this, because you start out with non-relativistic quantum mechanics, just three x's, x1, x2, x3, and then their momenta, but now suddenly, uncountably many degrees of freedom. Now, we will second quantize only the Klein-Gordon equation. And there are two reasons for that. One is that it's easiest. But secondly, it's the only case that is known to be of cosmological significance. So luckily, the simplest one is actually the most relevant one for cosmology. Of course, if what you want to study is particle physics, the kind of collisions that happen at the LHC, then you need to do the second quantization of the fermion fields, such as the quark field, the electron field, the neutrino field, and so on as well. Okay, but for our purposes, for cosmology, it's fine if we restrict attention to the Klein-Gordon field. Okay, so when we do this step of saying, okay, the Klein-Gordon equation is initially first quantized. It's simply the relativistic version of the Schrödinger equation. But then we want to upgrade that. And we want to make the Klein-Gordon field a field where at every point in space we have a degree of freedom, the amplitude, and a canonically conjugate degree of freedom, which is the time derivative of the amplitude. Then these two will no longer commute, and the field will be operator valued. So we get into a whole different kind of game there. And as we do that, it is convention that we switch notation from psi, which indicated, you know, which is reminiscent of Schrödinger's psi, to phi. And also we will no longer refer to phi as a wave function. Psi was a wave function, phi is not. Phi will be called a field. And that's an important distinction, because a wave function is always something which, when you take the modulus squared of it, you get a probability, or a probability density. But we know that in the relativistic case, that just doesn't work anymore. The phi of the Klein-Gordon equation in the first quantized theory is not consistently, cannot consistently be given a probability density interpretation. So it shouldn't be called a wave function. It's just a field. So let's do this then. Let's second quantize the Klein-Gordon field. Remember, the philosophy here is this. At every location x in space, we now have a degree of freedom sitting, phi, the amplitude, like the cork that can bob up and down. At every point in space, we have another degree of freedom. So now x is no longer an operator here, right? It's just a label of a point in space. And at every one of these locations, we have a degree of freedom phi. And it changes over time. It has the dynamics, the amplitude, right? It could be like the electric field, magnetic field, and so on. But we call it phi. And it will have a canonically conjugate momentum, which is its time derivative, just like the position has as its, in first quantization, its time derivative, its canonically conjugate momentum. Here we define a canonically conjugate momentum to phi of x, namely pi of x, which is the time derivative. So now we have the analog of x and p's. We have phi and pi. We can now rewrite the Klein-Gordon equation in this way. It's a very trivial rewriting of it. This is really phi double dot, right? Because pi is phi dot. So pi dot is phi double dot. So this is the second time derivative minus the sum of the second space derivatives plus m squared equal to zero. So it's really exactly what we used to have. This is just a D'Alembert operator acting on phi. We just rewrite it in this way so that we have explicitly positions and momenta, except that these are the amplitudes of a field and its canonically conjugate momentum. Now, the Klein-Gordon equation, here's a technical point that will be important throughout the course. It's a minor point, but I mean, it's a very simple point, but it's important. Look at the Klein-Gordon equation. Is there an I anywhere? No. The Schrödinger equation had an I in it. Right? It is I h body by dt, etc., etc., which meant that it naturally coupled the real part and the imaginary part of a solution, not the Klein-Gordon equation. If phi is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, then the real part is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, and the imaginary part is also a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. Because this equation does not couple the real to the imaginary part. They're independent. This is important because it tells us that it suffices to study the Klein-Gordon equation for real valued fields. Because then, once we can solve it for real valued fields, we have solved it also for imaginary valued fields just by multiplying with I. And then we can linearly combine the two solutions and we get all complex solutions as well. So in order to study the Klein-Gordon equation, it's completely sufficient to just focus on the real valued ones. In nature, it turns out both occur, real-valued ones and complex-valued ones. If a scalar particle, Klein-Gordon field describes spin zero, scalar particles, If a scalar particle is neutral, then it's described by real valued field. If it is charged, it's described by complex valued field. For example, the inflaton field that we will discuss in cosmology later on is described by the Klein-Gordon equation, and it's a real valued field before we quantize it, and then it's self-adjoint operator valued. But you can also consider particles such as particles obtained by combining a quark and an anti-quark. Then they can also be spin zero particles, but they might have a charge, in which case you have like a pi plus. Then you would have to describe it by a complex valued Klein-Gordon field. Okay, so what we will do is, in this course, we will focus on the real valued Klein-Gordon fields, because that's all we need for cosmology. And we are actually covering all possibilities with that too, because you can always get the complex valued from the real valued by just combining real valued and I times real valued solutions into complex valued solutions. Okay, so we have now introduced for our Klein-Gordon field phi of x and t canonically conjugate momentum fields pi of x and t. Now let's be serious about it and consider them in second quantization, meaning that we put hats over them and obey all the conditions that we do when we quantize. Namely, we will impose that the phi and the pi no longer commute. That is to say, generally they should commute. But when we consider the phi and the pi at the same position in space, then they are a canonically conjugate pair. Then they really should not commute. Right? So if you take phi hat at one particular location x, then its canonically conjugate observable or operator is phi pi at x. And those two should not commute. It's just like x1 in first quantization, in ordinary non-relativistic Schrödinger quantum mechanics, x1 and p1 don't commute, but x1 and p2 commute, and x1 and p3 commute. So here too, phi hat of x should commute with pi hat of x prime if x is not equal to x prime, but if it is equal, then they should not commute. And in a continuum like this, the thing to do is to put the Dirac delta here. So we have a Dirac delta on the right-hand side, and we should anticipate that there might be a little bit of trouble because it's a Dirac delta and not a Kronecker delta. But we do need a Dirac delta, because if it was a Kronecker delta and we would integrate over it, it would be of measure zero. So we have to have a Dirac delta there. Later we will see that if, for example, we want to calculate uncertainty principles or fluctuations of fields and so on, then we will deal with these Dirac deltas that occur there by smearing over a bunch of these degrees of freedom. So we will, for example, not consider how much does phi fluctuate at x. That will be an ill-defined question. Well, actually, the question is kind of well-defined, but the answer would be ill-defined. So we will not ask what is delta phi at x. The answer would be infinite. No, what we have to do is we have to integrate phi hat of x over some finite volume, and then calculate the average of that. So we just integrate it up, call this another operator, and then we ask, what's the expectation value of that? What's the uncertainty in this? How much does it fluctuate? And so on. So we will always smear a little bit over some space-time region in order to get something finite. Because once we smear our fields over some small space-time region, that smearing operation, that integration, tames the Dirac deltas that occur there. So this equation here, this canonical commutation relations, is in complete analogy to what we had in first quantization, where we had the Q and the P, and the Q and the P commute if and only if the indices A and A prime are different. We had the Kronecker delta here, but if A is equal to A prime, then we have IH bar times 1. Similarly, in first quantization, we have that the position operators all commute with each other no matter what. And here too, all the field amplitudes commute with each other independently of where you consider them, x or x prime. So they're still commuting. Also, the in first quantization, the momenta commute always with another. And that will still be true here in second quantization. So first quantization, second quantization. As always in quantization, making things non-commutative is the only thing we do. We try to keep the equations of motion the same. In first quantization, for example, for the harmonic oscillator, but it would be true also for the hydrogen atom in any other system, we keep the equations of motion. So for example, Q dot equal to P is an equation of motion. P dot equal to minus KQ would be the equation of motion for the harmonic oscillator. Here in second quantization, the two equations of motion are phi dot equal to pi and the Klein-Gordon equation. And we keep them. We just keep them exactly in the same form, except that now these are equations for different objects, for objects that have a hat on top of them and that therefore cannot be number-valued functions of space and time. They have to be operator-valued functions of space and time. Finally, we said we restrict attention to Klein-Gordon fields that are real number valued. So phi complex conjugated is phi. After quantization, it means that all the expectation values still have to be real. And that means that we require hermeticity. That means that phi hat dagger is phi. So realness translates for operators into realness of the eigenvalues, realness of the expectation values. And that condition is hermeticity, so that star becomes a dagger in second quantization. So overall, what we are seeing here is the full challenge of quantum field theory already laid out. What we need to do is find fields phi hat of x, such that the equations of motion still hold true, the phi hat is self-adjoint, its time derivative pi hat is self-adjoint, and that's the challenge, while we still maintain all of this, we also need to have these commutation relations. So there are always three things we need to achieve. Solve the commutation relations, solve the equations of motion, solve the hermeticity condition. This will be a common thread throughout the course, even when we introduce curvature and all of that. Three things are to be solved. Hermeticity, equations of motion, canonical commutation relations. Now, is there a Hamiltonian for second quantization? At this point, you'll have to make a mental leap here, because remember, we started out with the Klein-Gordon, with the Schrödinger equation, and we said IH bar dt psi equal to H psi, Schrödinger equation. And then what we did is we wrote it down in the position representation, or the momentum representation, and then said what it means is that E equal to P squared over 2m, and we upgraded that to the Klein-Gordon equation. Or you might upgrade it to the Maxwell equations, or you might upgrade it to the Dirac equation, etc. And then we had a first quantized covariant theory, and then we second quantized that. Now, please don't be surprised to find that this is still true. It's still true, but it has a different meaning now after second quantization. It's still true in second quantization, it's still true in quantum field theory, that there exists a Hamiltonian, there exist states, and the time evolution is generated by the Hamiltonian. Even though the equation of motion may be the Dirac equation, the Maxwell equation, Young-Mills equation, Klein-Gordon equation, whatever it might be. These equations may fall out, may be derived from this. In other words, what I want to say here is that quantum theory is not the same as quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics, usually people don't make much of a distinction between the two, but there is a subtle point. This is equal to non-relativistic quantum theory. Quantum mechanics is what they called first quantization. It is non-relativistic quantum theory. And quantum theory is a very abstract framework in which it is always true that there's a Schrödinger equation of this form, where there's a Hamiltonian, which is the generator of time evolution. So in abstract quantum theory, you always have a generator of time evolution, which is called a Hamiltonian. Super important, because imagine otherwise where we would be. In the Klein-Gordon equation, there is no longer a first-time derivative. It's a second-time derivative in the Klein-Gordon equation. In the Klein-Gordon equation, we wouldn't be able to identify what the Hamiltonian is. Is it the right-hand side of the Klein-Gordon equation, the Hamiltonian? It's not. That's not what it is. So what we will see is that the abstract Schrödinger equation is very deep at the heart of quantum theory. And it just so happens that in first quantization, it takes the form of the regular Schrödinger equation the way the Schrödinger first wrote it down. But it occurs also in second, third, fourth quantization, whatever you want to do. Any quantum theory, whether it's about quantum computing or quantum fields or whatever, the time evolution is always generated by an operator that is then called the Hamiltonian. So let's see how this comes out explicitly. Let's see if there is a Hamiltonian for second quantization. This question is to be understood in this sense. Is there an operator in second quantization such that this equation is the Klein-Gordon equation or the Maxwell equations or whatever? So let's see how we get this. Is there a Hamiltonian for second quantization? In particular, in our case, for the Klein-Gordon fields. Here it is. This is the Hamiltonian for the Klein-Gordon field. Let's go through it and see what it does. First of all, what is it? This is an integral over all of R3, over all of space, d3x integral. And then we are integrating over 1/2 p hat squared, plus 1/2, and then we have here phi m squared phi, and we have phi Laplacian phi. This Hamiltonian is analogous to what in first quantization would be a Hamiltonian for a harmonic oscillator. You see, we have here the canonically conjugate momentum squared, and then we have some business here with the phi, with the original degrees of freedom. Like in first quantization, in ordinary quantum mechanics, a bunch of harmonic oscillators would look like this. We have here pa squared, 1/2 plus, and then some prefactors, and then the q hat squared. This is not meant to be a derivation, right? I'm just pointing out a formal analogy. In fact, if I wanted to make that analogy closer, I would have to do something here. Namely, I would have to introduce here interaction terms between the harmonic oscillators. Look at this Hamiltonian here. It's the sum of the Hamiltonians of individual harmonic oscillators. There's a harmonic oscillator with p1 squared plus omega 1 squared q1 squared, and then there's another one with the 2, etc. This is just the sum of the Hamiltonians of a bunch of harmonic oscillators. Not quite the case here. Sure, we have a sum, but it's d3x. It's a continuum of sums of harmonic oscillators. But these harmonic oscillators are coupled to each other. How do you see that? Drop the Laplacian. In this case, they're not coupled. Because what we have is, if you just forget about the Laplacian, what we have is that for every x, we have a term with pi of x squared and a term with phi of x squared, right? M squared, phi of x squared. So if the Laplacian term is absent, we simply have a Hamiltonian term for every, for a harmonic oscillator term for every x. Right? For every x, we have a term pi squared and we have a term x squared. The only difference between this and that would be that here we have a continuum of harmonic oscillators. Here we have a discrete set of harmonic oscillators. That's all. Other than that, it would be exactly the same structure. But we have the Laplacian here. And what does it do? Well, it differentiates this thing in space. Now imagine, and we will get to this in more detail later on, but for now let me just sketch it. Imagine that space was discretized. Then spatial derivatives would be finite differences. It would be the value over there minus the value over here, right? That's what the first derivative is, and the second derivative just takes it one step further, literally. So in other words, in a discretized space, and you know integrals can be written as the limits of sums, we would have here finite differences of the phi. In other words, we would have that we are not just multiplying the phi of x with the phi of x, but also multiplying the phi of x with the phi of x a little bit of distance away. We would have multiple terms there, not just the diagonal ones with phi x and phi x, but also with the nearest neighbors and the nearest to nearest, next to nearest neighbors. In other words, we would have mixing terms over there, where we would have qa times qa plus 1. So we would have a, so what that means is that this Hamiltonian describes a bunch of harmonic oscillators that are coupled to each other. This is just a bunch of harmonic oscillators that are not coupled. But the structure is very similar. In fact, imagine we Fourier transform that Hamiltonian so that it's written in momentum space. Well, then everything looks the same except that these x's are p's and the Laplacian becomes p squared because under Fourier transform, derivatives become multiplications. So now there are no more derivatives. In momentum space, no more derivatives. In momentum space, this is literally just the sum of harmonic oscillator terms. In momentum space, we have here the pi of p, momentum space, and the phi of p squared. So what we have is that in momentum space, we have uncoupled harmonic oscillators. In position space, we have coupled harmonic oscillators. That's something that we will see throughout this course, namely that a quantum field consists of coupled harmonic oscillators when written down in position space. But after suitable transformation in Minkowski space, in flat space, it's just a Fourier transform. We can uncouple these harmonic oscillators. And in these new variables, after this transformation, they will be uncoupled harmonic oscillators. Anyway, so this is a Hamiltonian. And why are we justified to call this thing a Hamiltonian? Well, because it generates our equations of motion. It generates the evolution in time of phi and of pi. Let's see if that's true. So, let me write down something in quantum theory, which means not just in quantum mechanics, not just in first quantization, but I will write down something that's true in second quantization as well. And if you wanted to push it further to third or whatever, it would still be true. So what is f hat dot of t? You may already see it there. If I h bar f hat of t is equal to commutator of f with h. In the Heisenberg picture. This is just the Heisenberg picture version of that equation, right? So saying that this is quantum theory is the same as saying that that is quantum theory. It's just the Heisenberg picture version of this. So We're using this abstract equation from quantum theory, from everything to do with quantum. We always have that. See, it's so general, it's more general than the commutation relations between X and P. Because that's true no matter whether we work in first quantization, where it's the X and the P's that don't commute, or in second quantizations, where it's the phi and the P and the pi. Okay, so let's try it out. The claim is that this Hamiltonian in here generates our equations of motion. What are these equations of motion? Remember, the equations of motion are the Klein-Gödel equation, and what's the second one? Anybody know? Where did I put? Ah, here it is. Do you remember? You have two equations of motion. Klein-Gödel equation and we have that pi hat equal to phi dot, right? So the claim is that this Hamiltonian plugged into that abstract equation here for f being either phi or pi gives us this or that. Okay, let's see that. We can calculate the commutator between phi and h, and according to abstract quantum theory, something that should be true for whatever level of quantization you pursue, that should be ih bar, the time derivative of phi. And the time derivative of pi should be given by the commutator of pi with h. The time derivative of any other observable can be calculated the same way, just commute it with the Hamiltonian. So this Hamiltonian is designed in such a way that these two equations are the equations of motion. We can already anticipate which is which. Which of the two is the Klein-Gödel equation? Can you tell? Or should be the Klein-Gödel equation? And which of the two should be that relation? Any guesses? Well, look at the left-hand side. We have here phi dot equal to something. That ought to be pi, right? And then here we have pi dot equal to something. That should be the rest of the Klein-Gödel equation. Okay? So you see, the challenge is in second quantization to find a Hamiltonian such that it generates the relationship between phi and pi, and it generates the underlying equation of motion, such as here the Klein-Gödel equation. Let's see if it really does that. So here's the calculation. For the first one, for the first equation. So we want to calculate what is the time derivative of phi. We are expecting this to be pi. So we use this equation if we want to be true in quantum theory in general, no matter what you apply it to, first or second quantized theories. So we choose for f, phi. Right? Then we have here ih bar phi dot equal to the commutator of phi with h. So ih bar phi dot equal to the commutator of phi with h. If our h lives up to its reputation, this whole calculation should end up being pi, which it does, but let's see. Okay, so we have to calculate the commutator between phi hat of x and t and h. Here we have phi hat, and here we have the Hamiltonian. Now, the Hamiltonian is 1 half pi hat squared plus, I'm just writing here something of phi hat. Any idea why we don't have to spell out what that something of phi hat is? Why? Do you know? Yeah, exactly. It's something in phi, right? It's phi hat, m squared plus Laplacian phi hat. And yeah, well, the commutator of phi with phi is zero. So no matter what it is, the commutator is going to kill it. So we only need to work out what the commutator is between phi hat and pi hat. So let's write this out. And pi hat squared here, the integral of pi hat squared. So what do we get? We can forget about this stuff. we get a 1/2, let's put it in front of the integrand. And then we have here the phi hat, and then we have here the pi hat, and the pi hat outside plus pi hat, and then the commutator there. Do you remember how that works with the commutator of a square of something, right? You get these two terms. All right, and we know what that commutator is. It's just the Dirac delta. And here too, we have a Dirac delta. So we have Dirac delta, pi hat, and here we have pi hat, Dirac delta. The integral over d3x now eats up these Dirac deltas, and we get twice pi hat 1/2 and pi hat 1/2. So we just get pi hat. I should say that we didn't just get the Dirac delta. The commutator was ih bar times Dirac delta. So we get ih bar 1/2 Dirac delta. So overall, this is pi hat ih bar at x, because the Dirac delta made that x prime variable coincide with the x. So if we read now the entire equation, we see that ih bar phi hat dot is equal to ih bar pi hat. The ih bars cancel out, and we get phi hat dot equal to pi. Okay, so I leave it to you now as an exercise. Everybody should do that once in their life. To prove that if in that equation up there, you choose for f pi rather than phi, if you choose pi over there, then you get ih bar pi hat dot equal to something that you need to work out, namely the commutator between pi and h. Now the something terms will contribute, and you should get the Klein-Gordon equation then. Okay? So now you see how it is consistent that in any quantum theory whatsoever, you always have this Heisenberg equation and that Schrödinger equation, the same thing, just related to each other by change of dynamics, right? Schrödinger picture, Heisenberg picture, where you put the unitary time evolution on the state or on the operators. So you have this and that in any quantum theory whatsoever, with the first time derivative here, right? First time derivative here. You always have that, even though the equations of motion in the theory could be the Maxwell equations with its second derivatives, or it could be the Klein-Gordon equation with its second time derivatives, or it could be the Dirac equation, which has only first space derivatives and time derivatives. Any of that goes. These abstract equations generate that. Okay, so you see that the Schrödinger equation had two descendants. The Schrödinger equation of non-relativistic quantum mechanics, on one hand, led us to, going to the relativistic theory, it leads us to the Dirac equation, it leads us to the Klein-Gordon equation, leads us to the Maxwell equations, as relativistic generalizations of wave equations. On the other hand, the Schrödinger equation, viewed as an abstract equation, simply saying that the time evolution is generated by an operator, that statement can actually be maintained. And in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, as it happens, the two roles are played by the same equation. But in quantum field theory, we see now that the two roles are played by two different things. Right? We have these abstract equations of motion here that are always the same for whatever theory, fermions, bosons, whatever theory, always these hold. But the equations of motion of the traditional kind, the partial differential equations of the Klein-Gordon type, Maxwell type, and so on, they are secondarily derived then, and they are operator equations that pop out from this general, from these general equations by choosing the right Hamiltonian. Right? So you choose your Hamiltonian, and then that gives you your equations of motion. But every equation of motion, even the Klein-Gordon equation, is a Schrödinger equation. Right? So I hope you see that the Schrödinger equation has these two descendants, two kinds of descendants. One is, it still is alive in this form as the Heisenberg equation of motion or the Schrödinger equation of motion. But it also inspired, of course, as a partial differential equation. It inspired the generalization to the Klein-Gordon, to the Maxwell equations, and so on. All right, this is as far as we got today. And then next time we will follow up on this and calculate predictions and so on. Okay, any questions? Yes.
What is an interpretation of these states in the abstract Schrödinger equation?
Yes, we will get to this in the next two lectures. A super interesting question, and it will strain a little bit our mental abilities here, because it's getting pretty abstract. But I can anticipate it already since you asked. So what does a wave function ordinarily mean? Ordinarily, where did chalk go? Oh, there it is. A wave function would normally mean, you know, psi of x is the probability amplitude density for finding the particle at the location x. But now, what is it that we ask questions about? Are we still asking where is the particle? No. Now our degrees of freedom are not positions or momenta. Our degrees of freedom are the amplitudes of a field. So now we may want to ask, what is the probability amplitude density that if we measure our Klein-Gordon field or electromagnetic field, that it takes the values phi of x at t equal to t naught. So let me be precise. Imagine you pick a time and then you wheel out a magical measurement instrument with which you can measure the electric field everywhere, or the Klein-Gordon field. Everywhere. You measure its amplitude, let's say. Then, well, you will find some outcome, right? You will find some field configuration. You will a field configuration meaning amplitude, an assignment of amplitudes at every position. Right? So for every position, you know what the amplitude is. So you perform a measurement of t naught of all of your degrees of freedom. In first quantization, it would mean you're measuring not just x1, you're also measuring x2 and x3. Here we have infinitely many degrees of freedom. So we measure all the amplitudes of the field. And there is a probability amplitude for finding a particular field configuration. For example, there is going to be a probability amplitude, which you will have to take the modulus squared to get the probability. There's going to be a probability amplitude for finding that the electric field, it's just easier to visualize it, is, let's say, strong here and weak there and strong here over again. And, you know, it has some distribution, the electric field. There's going to be, depending on the state of your theory, what state the system is in, there's going to be some probability amplitude for finding this field behavior, I mean, not a spatial distribution, or maybe another distribution of the electric field or the Klein-Gordon field. And so you get the probability distribution for field configurations. For every field configuration, for whatever shape the field might take, you get a probability. And that is what a quantum field theoretical wave functional gives you. It's no longer a wave function, it's a wave functional. You know what the difference is between a function and a functional? You know, maybe not everybody knows. A function is something you plug in one number or maybe a few numbers and you get something out. That's a function. A functional is something where you plug in a function and you get something out. And that's the kind of thing we need now. A wave function only expected a few numbers as arguments, like a wave function, let's say position wave function. What does it expect as input? The coordinates, right? Like x1, x2, x3. And then it outputs the probability amplitude for finding the particle there. So it's a function. You just plug in x1, x2, x3, three numbers, you get a number. You get the probability amplitude out. But in quantum field theory, it's more complicated. Because here we are asking, what's the probability for finding that the electric field has this particular behavior? It's strong here, weak here, etc. In all details, right? What's the probability that the electric field is described by this exact function if I measure it? And what's the probability for finding the electric field to be described by exactly that function, or this function, or that function. So now your quantum field theory state has to give you a functionale, right? So you plug in any function, and then it tells you the probability for finding this one if you measure it. So in quantum field theory, you will have a wave functionale indicated by square brackets. And then you can plug in, for example, E vector of x. So this is the electric field as a function of all x, right? So I should put here all x. And then you ask, what's the probability that I find the electric field to be this particular function if I measure it at some time t naught? And so you plug that into your wave functionale, and you get out the probability that this is what you find. Okay, so you see this is one level higher. You plug in a whole field configuration. In other words, you plug in a function, and out you get a probability amplitude, which you will have to take the modulus square of to get the actual probability for finding this particular field. So for example, and this is what you will do in the next few lectures, imagine you take a box, cardboard box, close it, make sure that no light gets into it. So you have, in principle, the vacuum in there. Let's say that you make the boundaries, you make the walls of the box cold, zero temperature, so that there's no heat radiation going in there either. So then you should have the vacuum in there. But then, as you will see, a quantum field consists of harmonic oscillators. Actually, we saw it already in the Hamiltonian, right? It's like a sum of a bunch of harmonic oscillators. So it's a sum of, it consists of lots of harmonic oscillators. And they have ground state energies, and they have ground state fluctuations. So we should expect that if we measure the amplitude of, let's say, the electric field in the vacuum, there should be a chance that it's not zero. So if we ask, what's the probability, if the quantum field is in the vacuum state, what's the probability that if we measure the electric field, it happens to come out to be a particular vector field, then we get an answer. It's some probability. And the same for the Klein-Gordon field, of course. And in fact, nowadays, you can buy equipment that will measure that, that will measure the fluctuations of the electric field in the vacuum. It's a tool to generate random numbers, because vacuum fluctuations, I mean, quantum fluctuations are just very good random numbers. Okay, so this will actually be our aim for the next two lectures, namely to see how you calculate wave functionals in quantum field theory. So for any state such as the vacuum state or five particle states, you can ask, what's the probability that the field configuration is given by this particular function if I measure it, or that particular function if I measure it, etc. So you can calculate these probability distributions over the space of field configurations. And then, and this will be part of the project for this course, once you calculate these probability distributions, you can then draw from that probability distribution. So you get typical field configurations, and which you can then visualize. And then you can do the following experiment, numerical experiment. You calculate what the wave functionale is for the vacuum state, and draw from the probability distribution, and plot that. And you see a typical configuration of electric or magnetic or Klein-Gordon fields in the vacuum state. And then you can check, how does that differ in one, two, or three dimensions? What if you take a three-dimensional space, but you slice it and you only want to look at two dimensions? Is that the same as if the theory really lived only in two dimensions? It's not. Then what if you have in your box, not just a vacuum, but you have one particle bouncing in there, one standing wave, or maybe five standing waves, or one particle this way, one particle that way? How does that show up in the field configurations? And then eventually, what if space-time is expanding? Then that too will have an impact on the vacuum fluctuations and not just the vacuum fluctuations, but generally the fluctuations of your quantum field, they will all have an impact onto the wave functionals. And so the project then will be to play with that. Take some wave functionals, and at first do it just for Minkowski space, for various dimensions, various masses, various numbers of particles, and see, you know, how does the quantum fluctuations look like? If there are lots of fields, if there are no fields, dimensions, masses, and so on. And then explore a little bit, how does that change when space-time is expanding? And when it's expanding so fast that you have a horizon, and so on. Okay, so what we will do is, in the next two lectures, we will get pretty quickly to the machinery of wave functionals, so that you already know, you know, some backgrounds. You can, in principle, already start with the project and do all the Minkowski space stuff. And then we will take many lectures to do all of this very carefully, not so steeply right to the wave functionals, but more carefully, and build it up so that we can do it on curved spacetimes. And then eventually we'll do, you know, Hawking effect and inflationary cosmology. And then at the end, you should be ready to also extend these things then for expanding and curved spacetimes. So at the beginning of the course, very quickly, so that we can calculate some quantum fluctuations there. And then there will be a longer period in which we build things up very carefully, the whole framework of quantum field theory and curved spacetime. And at the end, you will have all the tools to do calculate quantum fluctuations and whether what circumstances. You can do it all. Okay, any further questions?
Yes? So what's the basis for your Hilbert space?
Yes, a very good point. The Hilbert space will have to be constructed afresh. You cannot just use the Hilbert space that we used to from our first quantization.
We still use the condition that it has to be separable, or does that not?
It would at first it would appear to be separable. It would appear to be non-separable, but non-separable Hilbert spaces are an enormous headache, and it turns out that you can avoid it. Basically, we know, well, two things work in our favor. We can assume that we are only considering a part of the universe, so we choose a box that's a finite size. Now that box could be 10 billion light years across. And if we do so, we know that whatever happens further at the boundary is not going to impact us here. It would impact us 10 billion years later, so if at all. So therefore, we are fine with making experiments and predictions if we have a box that's large enough. But it makes a huge difference if we put things in a box, because then we will have only countably many degrees of freedom in this. And then we can also use the fact that there is a pretty good scale separation, which means that what happens at one energy scale tends not to affect so much what happens at other energy scales. At least in the current version of the theories, that's the case. And so we can also introduce a so-called ultraviolet cutoff, where we assume that, you know, there are no wavelengths shorter than such and such, like the Planck length. In this case, if we have an infrared and an ultraviolet cutoff, then we have, in fact, a finite number of degrees of freedom. And when we have a finite number of degrees of freedom, then, the Hilbert space is separable, and we still have the Stone von Neumann theorem about the uniqueness of the representations and so on. We have to be careful, because sometimes we are missing things when we do this approach. For example, if we do quantum field theory in condensed matter physics, then we may have to take the thermodynamic limit, which is to say we have to remove the infrared cutoff in order to see phase transitions appear cleanly. Technically speaking, you can only have a phase transition in a system of infinite size, because if it's a finite size, you have analyticity, you can't have discontinuities. But of course, in practice, it doesn't have to be infinite in size. It could be just very large. I mean, for example, you could have a superconductor and just consider a tiny grain of it. It will still be pretty much a superconductor and go through a phase transition, even though it's not a system of infinite size. And in the universe as a whole, in the vacuum too, we assume that phase transitions have happened. And strictly speaking, if you want to describe a phase transition cleanly, then yes, you have to keep the system infinite, and then you find unitarily inequivalent representations for different phases, and all of that comes up. But the expectation is, of course, that it also happens if you put an infrared and ultraviolet cutoff, it just isn't so clean, because instead of having some discontinuity there, you would have some smoother thing, which is more realistic, but mathematically not as easy to describe. And by the way, no, I don't say that yet. It's more likely to confuse you than to clarify things. I will raise that issue later on. It's about how the XP commutation relations and the XP uncertainty principle still survives in second quantization. It does. It would be crazy if not, right? Because suddenly we could violate the uncertainty principle. No, that's not happening. Okay, I can tell you right. Okay, so the way it works is, just a sec, the way it works is this. When we write down something like this, we can write this down in position space or in momentum space. They're related by a Fourier transform, right? But what is the Fourier transform factor? What factor do we use when we do a Fourier transform? Well, we do an integral EIXP over H bar, and then we have phi of x d3x, and that would be phi tilde of p, right? And you would have 1 over square root 2 pi h bar something. I don't remember exactly what was there. But my point is, there's an h bar here in the Fourier factor. Unavoidably, this thing needs to be unitless. So xp has units, the same units as h bar. So this thing is there anyway, but where from? This h bar cannot be gotten from the commutation relations between phi of x and pi of x prime right. This h bar is unrelated to that h bar. Can't derive this one from that. This is a remnant of first quantization. In other words, first quantization sets the stage for second quantization. It tells you what position space is, what momentum space is, and how they're related to each other. Because in first quantization, when you look at this, the overlap of the eigenbase of the position and momentum operators, it is equal to, up to a normalization factor, e to the power I xp over h bar. And that's calculated from the commutation relation between the x and the p. So it turns out that first quantization is not gone. It's still there. It tells you how to go from the position to the momentum representation. The commutation relations of first quantization are still there. You see, if you go to momentum space, positions are derivatives with respect to p. If you go to positions, momentum is derivative with respect to x. That's just first quantization. So the first quantized h bar is still there. And curiously, you can't get that thing from this. Okay, I hope I didn't confuse you now. I'm trying to go super slow in these things because if not, they might be endlessly confusing. Okay. See you on Tuesday.